Reignite on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. We know that your focus is on your business. That's why ours is on supporting you.
And someone who has thought a lot about how to use his privilege and success is former Irish and Leinster rugby player Bernard Jackman, who is today advising companies on how to achieve high performance. We talk a lot about squiggly careers here on Reignite, and he's had just that, studying marketing and Japanese in college before going into professional rugby and then coming back out again to do a master's in sports management. And success, as he's going to tell us now, leaves clues that everyone can learn from, and he's been inside some of the biggest, most recognised brands and companies in the world today, trying to learn more about what makes them successful. Bernard, you're very welcome to Reignite. You were listening to the president and Katrina there, be the arrow, not the target. What does that mean to you?
Look, I think they both typify most great leaders in that they're very authentic, very honest, very transparent, and you know, they tell their own story and are not afraid to be open and honest. And being the arrow and not the target, I think it really fits in with something. I spent some time with a guy, I was very fortunate to spend some time with, like, a Wayne Smith, who's probably one of the, they call him the professor, he's one of the greatest All Black coaches and an ex-player as well, and has been at the heart of most of the good things that's happened with the All Blacks. And Brent Pope, who used to coach me in Clontarf, helped me, I suppose, get a meeting with him, and it was just fascinating, just so, some of the nuggets. But just when I hear that, be the arrow, not the target, you know, he used to speak about the mindset of being the hunter, not the hunted. You're either under pressure or you're applying pressure. You know, these things that as an individual in sport or in business or in life, you know, you've got to be pushing forward. You've got to be understand where you want to get to and what your mission is, what your purpose is, and then chase that and not be taken off track. And I remember in 2009, I was part of the Leinster team that got to the first ever European Cup final. We were playing Leicester and Murrayfield, and we'd beaten Munster and Croke Park in an amazing game, 82,000 people. And there was probably there was lots of distractions, and I remember we tapped into a story from a place called the IMG Tennis Academy in Florida, where it's one of the most elite academies for developing tennis players. But now they have NBA, NFL, the best sports teams go there to do training blocks, but also business teams and also military, so the SAS, the Marines, etc. And they have this little test that they do with people, and they bring them into a room and they say, look, your test for the next hour is, there's a white fence a kilometre away, okay, you got to run down that pathway there, touch the white fence and come back, and we're going to time you. And the big NFL players and the NBA team players get ready to go, and just before they leave the room they say, just by the way, be careful, there's wild boar along the creek, okay, and they can be dangerous, so just keep an eye out for them. So they have cameras all the way along the forest, and they watch these big athletes run off, and as soon as they hear the noise, they turn around and come back. But then they have cameras on the special forces, and when they hear the noise, they crouch down, assess the situation, see it's just a tape recorder, and they go and touch the white fence. So we tapped into that because our mission was to win the European Cup. For us, that was our white fence. And, you know, we just needed to make sure we do that. And, you know, the arrow, be the arrow, not the target. Understand, you know, where you want to go, and chase that with ultimate work rate, attitude, resilience, etc.
Passion and purpose that comes with it. And one of the things that defines teams, it doesn't matter if it's a workplace or boardrooms or dressing rooms, is often then a sense of connection and identity. And you mentioned the All Blacks there. They're amazing at creating a real sense of identity, like this is where you belong. Can you speak a little bit to the rituals there, maybe how we should all be thinking about that when we're trying to kind of bind loyalty amongst our teams and our people and communities?
Yeah, so they had a big reset. So they historically are the most successful international team in all sports in terms of win ratio, but they fell flat in their face at two World Cups. And Wayne Smith would have been part of, you know, review is probably too soft a word. It was an autopsy. You know, they basically said, look, this isn't working out. The patient is dead here. What do we need to do to get better? But didn't want to give up what was very important to them in terms of their heritage, in terms of their legacy. So they started with a blank page in terms of where they were going to go, but tapped into all the history of the great teams before them. So they have a charter around what makes a good All Black, and that's part of the selection. And the famous one is no dickhead rule, okay? Sorry for my language, but that's what they're happy to say, that you know, if your talent will only get you so far, but good people make good All Blacks. And you know, the ritual in terms of when you become an All Black for the first time, the CEO brings you to the head office, and you walk the corridor with him. You know, and you look at the photographs, you look at the artifacts of basically what's happened in the past, the great All Blacks of the past, and your opportunity to take that jersey and carry it forward and leave it in a better place. And of course they look at coach development, player development and all those things, but they have a big onus around the leadership group of the players being able to create more leaders. And that's what they say about great leaders. They don't create followers, they create other leaders. And they're very focused on that.
And you've been inside Old Trafford, particularly looking at the Alex Ferguson era and the Beckham glory days. But the rule you mentioned there for the All Blacks, it feels like that was a written rule or maybe unwritten rule for Alex Ferguson when it came to a player like Beckham, and that no one person is bigger than a team. What were some of the anecdotes you learned from Alex Ferguson?
Unfortunately, I'm a United fan, so I'm struggling at the moment. But I used to play for a team called Sale Sharks, and Old Trafford, Man United's training ground was beside ours. So I got a chance to, I suppose, observe them and speak to Ferguson about how he's built this incredibly successful organisation over 25 years, 26 years in total. But he said he had very three simple behaviours that he was willing to die on a rock for. They were be brave, okay, not just physically, but also in terms of choices you make. A Man United player never gives up. So always looking for examples of players giving up and challenging that, or not giving up and praising it. So it became part of their DNA. And that led to a thing called Fergie time, where United scored more goals in injury time than any other team. But the last one was team first. And it sounds so obvious, but the example he gave me was David Beckham, who he'd gone to London to sign as a 13-year-old with his head scout, spent a day on the train, and his wife gave out to him because she said, "Why are you bothering trying to sign a 13-year-old, because you'll never get the benefit from it, because most soccer managers last about a year and a half now, or even less." So he said, no, if I want to do the best thing for Man United, I need to do this. So Beckham was a great player. He said, great manners, unbelievable attitude, training, etc. But one day he scored a goal in Old Trafford, and his celebration, he sprinted towards the corner flag, dived on his two knees, hands over his head, and his teammates chased after him and jumped on him. And so Alex Ferguson realised that was different than he'd scored, or he celebrated when he scored a 14-23. So he called him in one day morning and he said, "Can you come up to see me this afternoon?" And Beckham came in and he said, "Tell me about your celebration." And he said, "Look, I spoke to my agent and my brand managers, and they said that photograph's going to get me on the front page and the back page, because that's where the cameramen were in the corner, our camera people." And basically, it was a great shot. And Ferguson said, no. If you score goals because someone else passed you the ball, if you score a free kick because someone else won a free kick, at United, team first. You got 24 hours, think about it. So next day, Beckham came in and said, "You're right, Gaffer. You know, I wasn't thinking about the team." And that was fine. He changed his behaviour for a while, until one day, a year and a half or so later, he scored a goal late in the game. I think it was in Tottenham Hotspur. And bang, corner flag. And on the Monday, Ferguson called him up and said, "We talked about this last year. You should be very clear about my feelings on this. You're going to what's your decision?" And he goes, "No, I'm going to do this because I need to think about my life after football." Now, he's just made about half a billion out of Miami, so he's done well in terms of building a brand.
He's gone on to good things.
But Ferguson went to the board and said, "We're going to sell David Beckham," and obviously there's a big pushback. But he said, "No, it's me or him in the end." And they sold him to Real Madrid, and he said, "I lost David Beckham, the player, and that was a loss. But what I won was the dressing room." And this total understanding that there's certain things that are non-negotiable, because he always hired or fired based around those three behaviours. And he said it was pity that he lost someone who's a good guy, but just that he would not conform to the behaviours that were agreed upon by everybody.
Because it comes back to great teams are those that win together but also fail together. And you've looked at companies like Dyson as well. You know, I think there was something like 5,126 attempts to get the first bagless vacuum. And, you know, just that teamwork that's required, the constant iteration, the constant resets, going back to the drawing board and fail again and start again and do better, and just that constant cycle. Is that also what makes teams great? Just that stubbornness?
Yeah, I think you have to have that stubbornness. I mean, James Dyson's fascinating. I mean, he's the richest man in the UK, 20 billion. I'm a son of a cattle dealer, so he's the biggest landowner in the UK as well. But he wasn't self-made. His father was a classic teacher, and he got a scholarship at boarding school because his dad died when he was 12, and had a tough time in school. But he had this vision that he could create a vacuumless Hoover. And the reason he's the richest man in the UK is he never took on outside investment. He's totally privately owned. So when he was pushing to basically find that perfect prototype, his wife got a second job, they remortgaged the house, he got a second job. So the pressure must have been immense. And I asked him, "How did you deal with failing 5,126 times in a row? And he said, "Well, I knew I was only changing one part of the process each time. And as long as I didn't double back on ourselves as a team, we'd get there, you know. And again, it's that whole idea of, I believe I can do it. I believe I have the right people around me to do it, or we believe we have the right people around me to do it. And failure is not final. In actual fact, the environment they create is, and they're trying to invent an electric battery now, a battery for electric cars that'll have a range of 2,000 kilometres, and a team are all focused on that, is fail fast. Fail fast. Put your hand up and say, this hasn't worked. Let's, you know, what can we modify to go again? Because obviously if you don't fail fast, you're never going to get 2,000 prototypes, you know.
And it's a phrase used by tech companies all the time, but of course it feels like Samuel Beckett was there long before when he talked about ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better. And the best teams are resilient about that. You have a mantra that you really believe in for a lot of teams like that, that operate with this high performance mentality, that is, think like a gardener, work like a carpenter. What do you mean by that?
So basically, I think the great leaders I've had, whether they've been sporting or I've observed in the business world, they understand that to create a really strong environment or to create success, they need to have the balance. So sometimes, you know, if the mood or the environment is poor, they need to try and nurture that to get people back together, to get people connected, to get people attached to the goal. And that's being like a gardener. So a gardener, you know, nurtures the soil, etc. And then the carpenter is someone who, you know, it's process driven. You know, he or she has the right tools, they have the right measurements, they know how to put things together. So if you want to build a table, there's a process to that. And at certain times they need to be very much on the carpenter side, certain times they need to be very much on the gardener side. And some weeks or days they're a mix of both, but they're in tune with that, you know. And there's a really good study. So I did a thesis on the correlation between high performance behavior and sport and business, and the academic side of it, there's two guys, Barron and Hannon, two professors from Stanford University, who wanted to examine high performance culture, and they got funding to go into Silicon Valley for 2 years. They ended up taking 20 years, okay. And they've worked, they basically have decided that there's five different types of culture: star culture, bureaucratic culture, autocratic culture, engineering culture, and a commitment culture. They all can be successful, okay, but the commitment culture is 22% more successful than the others. And the commitment culture is that leadership style, generally, where people are collaborative. They bring people together, they make people feel good. And, you know, they say high performing environments find it easy to attract the best talent, but also keep the best talent, and attention. They build that cohesion. And that's what I've noticed on my travels. And like, I try and go away every year to somewhere that I admire from the outside and try and see how they do it. But the more of these places I visit, the more I see a really strong emphasis on the people, you know. And just, you know, the whole thing about think like a gardener, act like a carpenter. My president, I was a professional coach in France for 5 years, and every Monday morning I had to go to my president, who's the CEO, and do a debrief, okay? But he used to always say, le mayonnaise est bien pris ou pas, right? Which basically,
sorry for
my French accent, means the mayonnaise is well taken or not. And it's an old French proverb, because the French love their food, okay, as I do. And every French town or village or region has its own cuisine. And effectively, the chefs take great pride in their craft. So they don't buy in Hellmann's or Heinz. They make their own mayonnaise. So the mayonnaise is well taken or not, basically, is an analogy in that to make good mayonnaise, you need good ingredients and you need a good process. But the great chefs, when the ingredients are out of season, they adapt the process. And his idea was, well, you're the coach of the team. The ingredients are the players, the management. And basically, on one Monday morning, they could be in great form, and the other Monday morning, they could be down because of a defeat, etc. Or there could be personal issues or external issues. So how are the ingredients? How are the players and the staff? And then, you know, what's your process this week? You know, because the ingredients mightn't be great. You might have injuries. You might have a poor morale. But how are you going to change the process to try and get a performance on Saturday? So I think I see it. People don't know. They don't use the mayonnaise as an analogy, but they do that every day. The really good leaders, they're conscious of the fact that the ingredients are the people, and then the process is all the tools they have to try and get to the end goal.
And just finally, Bernard, you mentioned culture there, and I feel like it's been a word bandied around even in recent weeks again. And culture at the, you know, back to its very beginnings with the Latin meaning, it's just care. What do you think is at the heart of great cultures, be it in communities, be it in sports teams, be it in boardrooms, startups, whatever it is? What is it?
I think at its core, it's respect. respect for the people that are part of your team, and caring for them, and showing them that you care. I think you do that on a daily basis, your culture will be pretty strong.
Yeah, culture eats strategy for breakfast, as they say. It's so important. Bernard Jackman, thank you so much for that. Rugby pundit, motivational speaker and performance consultant. We'll be back after these with much, much more to come.